Good evening and welcome, everyone. I'm Matt Miller with the Craft Beer Nation, and we are having another BJCP style category review session, whatever you want to call it. We're going to spend a little time here tonight talking about Category 4, which is Dark Lords. So we've kind of been moving our way from through the categories and spending some really good time exploring the makings of lagers, and it seems like we've just been getting a little bit darker each week. We did amber lagers last episode, and this time we're into dark lagers, which is an interesting category to several of us. So without further ado, I'll introduce our panel real quick. Our BJCP judge again tonight is David Hausman. Dave, how are you this evening?
Very good, thank you, Matt.
Well, good. And we've got a few warm bodies from CBN, from Craft Beer Nation. Our moderators are Jeffrey Davis, Boris Castillo, Ashley Bauer, and myself. So we're looking forward to a spirited conversation about dark lagers. And I guess we'll kick off with Dave here. Dave, tell us a little bit about the category and why the things are broken down the way they are, or what the three subcategories are.
Okay. All right, so dark lager is pretty much as it says. These are lagers, and they're darker than what you would think about in terms of light lagers. They're not always black, but I would say very dark amber to black. So that's the dark part of dark lagers. Two of these, the Dunkel and the Schwarzbier, are traditional German beers, been around for a very, very long time. Dark lager is more of a American dark lager, and it's not necessarily American. The reason I hesitated, because there are other beers in the world. There's a dark Heineken, there's a dark St. Pauli Girl. There are dark lagers other than American, but what these tend to be is a very dark version of what would be a premium American lager. So what they have in common is lagers, clean, crisp, not so fruity as ales. And what they have difference, though, is how they came about getting to be dark. And that is not just the color, but also what happens in flavor and aroma as well.
All right. Well, let's start right with some questions about the dark. We haven't really talked much about grain roasting in our previous sessions here. Who wants to take off with how malts and grains get roasted and how they get to the different depths of dark and what their characteristics are when they get there?
Well,
everybody's looking at you, David.
No, Ashley was ready to jump right in. That's fine.
Please do, Ash.
Kristen asked about this earlier today, and she was talking about maltsters and what they do to the grain and take the grains and they, wet it, go down, germinate the grains, and then stop it at a certain point so that we can get the sugar out of the grains. It's a very elementary way of saying it. But they also, in addition to making the grains able to be used, they can roast it down to different colors and caramelizing and smoking and all that cool stuff. And so I guess that's what we're seeing here with the dark lagers, is it's just a darker roast on the grain, but a similar grain bill to the light lagers.
Yeah, that's pretty much. If you look, though, at the two extremes, the dark American lager tends to be, I'll say, like a six-row malt, maybe some corn, similar to what you would find in an American lager, but then adding some either roasted grain, roasted barley, malt, or some caramel, which is, again, a crystal malt or a caramel malt, is, in fact, roasted, just not to the same extent as chocolate or black would be. But also, they tend to use a caramel coloring as well. So you're not even using grains that are roasted to that extent. They may just use commercial caramel coloring. Things like Michelob Dark, I don't even know if they still make that. I guess they do. I haven't had that in years. But in any case, they're using there's almost no roast flavor at all in the Dark American Lager. Just slightly sweet lager, black or very dark brown, and but no roast flavor aroma, really. Whereas if you go with the other extreme, the Schwarzbier actually does use some dark roasted grains. They may actually use something like Carafa, which is it's like a chocolate malt, chocolate malt grain. They even use dehusk, which takes the husks off, so you're not contributing to astringency or to the husky roastiness from the husk of the malt. Even that, though, is not going to be as roasty as, say, a stout that's using roasted barley. And then in between that, you have the Dunkel, which is really nearly 100% Munich malt, or maybe Munich with some Pils malt. Maybe some places might use a little bit of Crystal, but in general, that can be 100% Munich.
All right. Well, what kind of malt characters then are we looking for? Are the three beers in this category, the three subcategories, are they significantly different when it comes to malt build? Or you were saying that there were the dark American lagers used less roasted malt than some of the other ones do. But how do we differentiate these beers, the subcategories?
Well, they do. They are going to be different. Not so much the grain bill. Let's leave that in a minute. How you get there? But let's talk about aroma and flavor. So the Schwarzbier is going to be some roastiness, some crisp, sort of not acrid. You know, it's not like a stout, but you will get a noticeable roast character to the Schwarzbier. They should be clean. That is, very low, if no fruitiness, no diacetyl, right? They should have balanced bitterness, but they're malt-forward beers, not like a Pilsner. So think about it as... malt first, but then the supporting bitterness for that. The Schwarzbier, I don't believe you're going to get much in the way of any hop aroma or flavor, whereas in the Dunkel, you may have a little low to no noble hop flavor. The difference in the Schwarzbier from the Dunkel is the Dunkel should be more of a rich melanoitens, the bready toastiness of Munich malt. That beer, probably over all the others, really would do well with a decoction mash that gives you the rich melanoitens. You're going to get a lot from the Munich malt anyway, so it's not really necessary, but it would be helpful. They're all kind of medium-bodied beers. The Dark American lager is probably going to be a little bit lighter in body and mouthfeel than the Dunkel and the Schwarzbier. The Schwarzbier will actually be nearly black, perhaps not opaque, but nearly black, whereas the Dunkel tends to be just dark, say dark amber to a lighter brown from the Munich malts. And the Dark American lager, whether it's actually an American version in a brew pub, that's probably all grain and probably using some chocolate or even roasted barley, enough to darken it, but not enough to add significant to the flavor profile. Whereas a large commercial brewery probably does use some coloring, commercial coloring agent, caramel coloring agents, rather than necessarily using a dark roasted grain. But they're all clean, crisp lagers. Those malt profiles, though, are pretty distinct.
Yeah. I can remember back in the in the 90s, early 90s, that Anheuser-Busch put out a product called Michelob Amber Bock. Was that what it was called?
It's still out.
Is it still out?
Yes.
Yeah. And it was a, I think they just made that as dark as they could, but it didn't taste any different than any of the other beers that I'd had from them, and I guess that's...
And they also now put out, they still have Amber Bock by Michelob, and then now they are trying to make a spin-off, a crafty beer. It's called Ziegenbock, and it is literally Michelob Amber Bock. The difference is they're claiming that it's a Texas-brewed beer because they use a big Texas emblem behind the word Ziegenbock. And I'm assuming they're taking a spin off of, you know, like German tradition with the word Ziegen. I have no idea. I don't really care for it. But as soon as you lift up the 6-pack or the 12-pack case, on the bottom it says product of Michelob Brewing. And I was like, really? I was like, why don't you just get rid of Amber Bock and then do this? If you're going to come out with this crafty stuff, you're confusing even your customers. I was like, that's so sad.
All right, so Ashley, Gil, Jeff, who has some more questions about some of the intricacies of the sub-style here? Have any of you ever brewed a lager of this style? Well, I guess you might be the only one that's tackled a lager.
Yeah, I haven't done a lager yet.
I haven't brewed a dark lager yet, no. Only my classic American Pilsner. I did have a question, though. You mentioned it real quick. In your guidelines, you have commercial versions may use coloring agents. Now, by commercial versions, are you referring to the big two, or are you just are you categorizing commercial as everything?
No, really the larger things like Michelob Dark.
Okay. When you mentioned that, I figured that's what you meant, but the first time I read it in the guidelines, I was like, versions, huh?
I'm trying to think. I just can't think of the name of it right off the top of my head right now, but there is a German dark coloring syrup that meets Rheinhaschgebot, because all it is essentially roasted barley that's dehusked barley, Karaffe, that's been the extract from that. So it's extremely dark and black and can be used as coloring, but doesn't add much in the way of flavor or aroma at all. I'll think of the name of it as we go along here, maybe.
Is the Guinness Black Lager considered Schwarz beer? Do you know?
I don't know. I haven't tried that one. Quite honestly, I don't know. It may be they just took the similar recipe to what they have, which would have roasted barley, and made a lager instead of an ale out of it. But I don't know the answer to that.
So category 4B is a Munich Dunkel. I can kind of gather where the Munich came from, but what's the history on Dunkel? Is that a region of some place, or is that...
Dunkel is a German word for dark.
Oh, well, okay.
and
next question.
Yeah.
It's
the Dunkel.
Very anticlimactic. Yeah.
And
I was expecting like this humongous hard for answer. Oh, it just means dark.
And actually, that was a question that people couldn't answer. We should have let somebody else take those kind of softballs.
And Schwartz means black.
Oh, well, good. You headed off my 4C question.
Yeah, I didn't want you to embarrass yourself.
Well, I'm used to that. That's a constant state.
Yeah, Schwarz and black. And there's when we get to the other category, there's a lot of people, they confuse Weiss beer and Weiss beer, Weissen.
Right. Yeah.
Weissen and Weissen. Although they can be the same beer, but one meaning white, and the other one has to be wheat.
Yeah.
So there's all those confusions that happens when you get so many words coming from German or Austrian backgrounds.
What kind of things do you look for? I mean, have you judged these categories much, David?
Yeah, I the way BJCP judging kind of works is you show up at a competition and you get assigned to whatever. They try to collect ahead of time, what would you prefer to judge, what do you not prefer to judge, what you don't want to judge. And then if you've entered something, obviously you can't judge the categories you've entered.
Right.
So generally I just say, whatever. I'm willing to judge most anything. So over the years, I've judged everything several times or multiple times, but it's sort of hit and miss whether or not I've judged good Schwarzbiers or good Dunkels or whatever.
Is there, are there a lot of homebrewers making this class of beer?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty popular. Not as much as, say, the Hopheads are making IPAs.
Yeah.
A lot of the newer brewers tend to be making IPAs and stouts. They're a lot more forgiving beers, I would say.
Yeah, you can hide a lot more with the high bitter.
And for a homebrewer, by the time they get to making a Schwarzbier, they're making lagers in general. And so it's, by that point in time, they're usually fairly good brewers. If you've gone to the expense and trouble of getting a lagering fridge and understand what you're doing with lagers to come up with a clean lager, they tend to be fairly good brewers. And so the Schwarzbiers and the Dunkels, I would say, tend to be pretty good. Not always. I mean, you get somebody that didn't take a lager through a diacetyl rest, and you've got a very buttery beer. But that could happen whether it be a dark beer or a light beer.
The lagering process here, is it any different? I mean, or is it just get it cold and leave it sit?
Basically the same. It's really the same for all lagers. Rule of thumb is you're going to primary fermentation about one day for every degree Plato. So a degree Plato is roughly a specific gravity of 4. So if you take a normal beer at 1048, that's roughly 12 Plato. Your primary fermentation is going to be 12 days. And the temperature of that really depends on the yeast you're using. I typically am somewhere around 50 degrees or so.
And then after those days, you cool it off.
Well, generally you take it, raise the beer from the 50 degrees up to room temperature for a couple or 3 days as a diacetyl rest. Yeast is producing diacetyl. At the lower temperature, it's not reassimilating the diacetyl as fast. So if you were to crash the beer cold and the yeast crashes, it goes out of suspension really quickly, you could leave a lot of diacetyl in the beer. That's a fault. If you raise it, the yeast is more active at the warmer temperature. It reabsorbs the diacetyl. It's not producing as much at that stage of fermentation, so it's reabsorbing that diacetyl. And then you lower the temperature down a couple of degrees a day until you get to a lagering temperature of basically right around freezing, 32 degrees. It won't freeze because of the alcohol, but as cold as you can get it. And you leave it there for, rule of thumb again, 1 week for every degree Plato, original gravity. So if it was a 1048 beer, that's roughly 12 degrees Plato, you're going to leave it in there about 12 weeks at that. Now, that's just a rule of thumb. It's probably drinkable sooner than that, and in my fridge, it probably stays a lot longer because I'm just not drinking the beer as quickly. So it's essentially lagering until I finish it.
Now, we talked about this on the Pilsner show or one of the other shows. This is all in this. You don't rack off of the yeast. This all sits in the same fermentation vessel. It's just changing the temperature.
Now, once I go through the diacetyl rest, then I'll rack it off of the what yeast is in there. There's still plenty of yeast in suspension at that point, and it will. The yeast in suspension will reabsorb any leftover diacetyl or maybe acetaldehyde, and eventually will drop out of suspension. I don't leave it on the yeast for that long, only because you could get autolysis, which is the yeast kind of breaks down the cell walls, break down and can give you a kind of like burnt rubber tires. If you burnt a rubber band and smell that, you can get beer that tastes like that and smells like that. And it's the cell wall of the yeast breaking down. Usually won't happen in short times, like primary fermentation through, say, a diacetyl rest, but if you left it in there for 3 months, it could happen. I've tasted beers where it did happen.
So how does that jive, Boris, with what we talked about before? Is it different beers for different processes for different beers? Because wasn't Phil?
I would say. I mean, if you're gonna go with the rule of, with the David's rule of thumb of a wee per plate out degree, the majority of the lagers in category two aren't very high with an original the gravity. So, I mean, the highest for the German Pilsner is 1050. The highest for the Bohemian is 1056, and the highest for the Classic American is 1060, and that's an extreme. And I would feel that's an extreme. So I mean, would you do it for 12 weeks? I mean, I guess if you want to go traditional, yeah. But if you do, I would for 12 weeks, I would rack it. For my Classic American Pilsner, I did not rack it. I fermented it as soon as I knew it was pretty much done. Brought it up to diacetyl rest for 2 days. It's 65. 68, pretty close to 70 when it got hot. As soon as those 2 days were over that night, put it back into my kegerator, dropped the temperature to 34, and it's been sitting at 34 for now 3 weeks. This weekend, I will be racking it to a keg to filter. I'm going to filter it through a 5-micron filter. Then I will keg it, put it on gas, and let it do its thing to carbonate. Now, if I were to do it for 12 weeks, I would rack it and do the lagering for the 12 weeks. I would be afraid to leave a beer on spent any kind of yeast, hop residue, all that jazz for 12 weeks or more. I mean, or longer. I mean, if I take the Classic American to 1060, you know, that's a good while lagering. So if I were to go traditional, so I mean, I don't want to say Phil is wrong because he obviously knows more than me, but I guess it varies by, I would guess by, it would vary by beer or brewer or both.
A lot of that, as you say, Boris, is you may find different breweries being more traditional. Some are trying to push things through as quickly as they can. There are ways to accelerate that lagering. The use of the beechwood aging, if you would, right? You're keeping more yeast in suspension by giving it a place to settle other than at the bottom of the fermenter. That's one way of doing it. The ice beers were originally developed by Molson or Labatt as a way of accelerating lagering. It was flash freeze it, ice crystals form around various impurities in the beer, suspended particles, you filter that out, you add water back in so you didn't change the alcohol content substantially, and you've essentially lagered very quickly. So there's different approaches, and the resulting beers may be a little different. I won't say that any one is right or wrong.
Yeah, and the only reason I do mine for 4 weeks is the first time I did it for 4 weeks because I didn't know how long to do it. So I happened to catch one of the many contributors to BYO magazine. It was actually the Mr. Wizard column. And he was on Facebook taking questions. And I posted a question about lagers, told him I made a Classic American. And I told him it was already on for 4 weeks. How long should I lager? He's like, oh, man, you could have stopped lagering 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh,
Well,
so the next day I racked it, filtered it, and then pressed on. And ever since then, I've just lagered it for 4 weeks. I didn't want to change anything because I was afraid the beer would be completely different. And I loved that version.
And it may be different. And that's a good learning thing for anybody would be to taste it over a period of time and taste how it changes. And you may get to a point where that's really what I want. And you stop the filter it or whatever and really bottle at that point. Okay, gotcha.
So how do you change these fermentation? You've got to have a refrigerator with a control on it, a thermostatic control.
Yep.
You know, I think Jeff Davis, we were talking last week about you're building them out of a freezer with a Johnson control.
Yeah, I am. I actually just got my second one in the mail today, so now I have a fridge that I've been using, a chest freezer that I've been using for my fermentation cooling, the Johnson controller, and now I have a second Johnson controller that I'm going to be using for a lagering fridge.
Yep.
All right. Well, cool. So just set it and forget it, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
From a tasting perspective, it seems like there's a lot of things that can go wrong here. Your primary fermentation is not the right temperature, or you don't give it enough of a diacetyl rest, or you lager it 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 9 weeks. I mean, how do those things drive through into flavor? I mean, how does David Hausman recognize and say, "Oh, you could have lagered this longer, or lagered this too long"?
So when you judge, there's some things you shouldn't assume. You know, you shouldn't assume that the brewer was an all grain versus extract. Sometimes you can kind of really, with some assurance, figure it out. But not always. And so you have to be careful about what you assume. Did they lager long enough? You can't really tell that so much. What you can tell is whether or not the primary fermentation was at a cold enough temperature. If it's got a lot of esters, fruitiness, then either it was an improper yeast, not enough yeast was pitched, or the primary fermentation temperature was too high, those kind of things. What causes esters? When yeast is fermenting or beginning to grow, when you first pitch yeast in, it gets acclimated to the environment that it's in, and the yeast starts to reproduce. And during that growth cycle is when most of the esters are generated. So when you're making a lager, you want to pitch as much yeast as you can right away. You want to get past the growth phase very quickly and get into actual fermentation. Whereas with an ale, you want those esters. You want the fruitiness of in an ale, whether it be an IPA or an English bitter. So you pitch less yeast, let that yeast grow up in that environment, reproduce, generate esters, and finish fermentation. So you can tell something about the yeast that was pitched or the environment that was in. And I would say or at least some of the lagering. You can't tell whether it was 12 weeks or 4 weeks or 16 weeks always. But if it's a real clean, crisp lager, like the ones you buy. I mean, drink a Budweiser and you can tell it's a lager beer or the Koster that Boris had there a little bit ago.
Now on this style that we're talking about today, I don't know if it's a common thing, but I noticed among my friends that they relate the strength of the beer with the color. And we see on this style how those are very those session beers with between 3.5 to 5-6%. So although they're a darker beer, they're still very light. Beer they can easily drink a few of them. And do you know any reason why people tend to relate color?
I think it's just somewhat they're anticipating something that doesn't exist. It's it's not stupidity, it's just ignorance on their part. They're not aware that you can have flavor without necessarily a high alcohol. And the converse of that, take a look at a triple that's very light in color but very high in alcohol. So the two are not correlated.
Do you think it's because, you know, for a very large percentage of American beer drinkers, you've got one beer, you know, whether you like Coors, Miller, or Budweiser, they're all the same beer, and, you know, and then there's Guinness. So those are the two beers that they had to choose from in this world. And, you know, perhaps that's where some of that association comes from. Oh, well, this isn't Budweiser, so it must be stronger.
It could be. And, again, it's just not knowing.
Right.
A draft Guinness, a dry stout, is, you know, what, 3.2% alcohol?
Yeah, right.
It's a great session beer.
Yeah.
Speaking of alcohol, none of these beers should you really taste a lot of alcohol or smell a lot of alcohol when you judge it. They're not very high alcohol beers. You know, there may be some minor warming to the mouthfeel and to flavor, but very little. So if you judge one and you're tasting a lot of alcohol, something is wrong. You know, they may have used a lot of adjuncts, sugar that fermented out, or they started at too high a gravity or something. Right?
Before we leave these categories, I'm looking at BJCP and I see, you know, our next couple of weeks and the things that we're moving towards. Before we leave these light lager, amber lager, dark lager box, it's in 2 weeks. A word that gets thrown around a lot, be it from marketing, from Anheuser-Busch, or be it from just beer talk, is drinkability. And this is a highly drinkable beer. This is a, you know, where does that
crispy
fit in? Yeah. Where does, and I think every beer is drinkable. So, you know, you know, except for a Voodoo Donut or something, right? So I'm just kind of wondering, where does that term fit into judging? Is that something that you consider when you're reviewing a beer, or is that just pure marketing speculation?
Well, I think what you probably read is marketing in terms of what does drinkability mean? I don't know if there's a definition somewhere, but if you look at the BJCP judging form, the last section is overall impression and drinkability. So let's take an example of beers that I've judged. One was a mint blonde ale. This beer was green. I mean, it was a bright green beer in the bottle. You poured it in the cup, and it was bright green. They had used fresh mint in a blonde ale to make this beer. And it was entered in specialty, so fine, that was good. And you judge that, and it was exactly what they intended it to be. You give them kudos for that. They did a good job of creating this beer. It was balanced. It wasn't, you know, there weren't any real brewing faults to it. However, could I drink a pint of that? No. To me, that wasn't very drinkable. And I like to say sometimes, just because you can do something doesn't make it a good idea. Don't try to make anything and everything just because you can. You want things that you actually drink and enjoy. Drink at least a pint, maybe two pints, maybe more, right? So that's where the overall impression and drinkability comes in judging. It's not just flavor, aroma, appearance, or mouthfeel, but how all of these elements come together in the enjoyability, the could you drink more than one?
Well, you know, that's interesting because it, this evening at dinner I had a palate wrecker from Green Flash, and it did not pair well with dinner because it was, anybody who's not had this beer, it's a, I think it's 100 and some IBUs and 9 or 10% alcohol, and it did not pair with the pizza that we warmed up from the other night very well at all, because it was so overpowering. So that would get a low drinkability score. No matter all the interesting hops that are there for the hop heads, I couldn't find anything that I thought, wow, I'd love to have three of these.
Right. So, exactly. So I think it does mean something. Now, in a Anheuser-Busch marketing sense, they want you to drink multiple beers.
Yeah.
Not just the one.
That's how they're
not making a barley wine that you're going to sip one of on a cold night like tonight.
Right.
They want you to drink a six-pack or whatever. That's drinkability.
And I guess that's also very subjective, because we have a moderator in the group that would take a growler of stout to sit on the beach with. You know, I mean, so we all have our own tastes, our own appreciations. Yeah. So
you're exactly right, Matt.
I wonder, and that's, to me, that's where the mouthfeel is so important, right? I think sometimes drinkability has a lot to do with that mouthfeel. You get all the stuff around your mouth. It becomes so heavy that you can't drink anymore. I had a February tart, something tart, I slipped the name. It was, after a while, it got so stringent and so harsh on my mouth that was hard to keep going. You know, I drank because it was $20 a bottle, but
you powered through it. Yeah.
I powered through it, but I wish I had something to cap it and drink more later on. But
yeah.
Can you talk about the mouthfeel of this style of, like, Schwarz beer, and what you're expecting when you
take a sip? Okay, I don't have the style guides right in front of me, but generally these are going to be medium bodied, maybe a little on the lighter side of body. They're all well carbonated beers, so you should have a little bit of zing to the carbonation. The one thing I would say and talk about in terms of body and mouthfeel is attenuation. One of the biggest problems, I think, with a lot of homebrews is a lack of real attenuation. You want the beer to be fully fermented, well attenuated. That gives it a clean, crisp impression and mouthfeel. And you can tell that in a beer that, you know, it just feels like it has too much body. It, you know, maybe they use a lot of crystal. They use too high a fermentation or a mash temperature that left a lot of dextrins. Maybe the fermentation didn't go all the way to completion for some reason, and the yeast died out. But you look at the most commercial beers, one of the things that distinguishes them from many homebrews is they're more attenuated. Doesn't mean they're thin body. They're left with what they're supposed to for that category, but you don't have that kind of sense of thickness, I would say, right? Even barley wines. I mean, take an Anchor or a Sierra Nevada barley wines or any of the really good classic barley wines. And even those, even though it's a bigger body, it's a full-bodied beer, they're well attenuated. It gives you some crispness to it. These beers, in terms of mouthfeel, won't have alcohol warming or very low, if any. Obviously, if you drink enough of anything, it will be pretty warming after a while. But it won't be like a Belgian double, triple. Won't be like a barley wine, old ales, that kind of thing. You should not have astringency, either from hops or from the malt. Even though they have a little bit of roast in it, it shouldn't be to the point that you're left with any kind of astringency in these beers. And that's about it. Well, go ahead.
I don't know how it's for everybody, but on the beginning, I had a lot of mistakes of confusing mouthfeel and flavor, you know. And it took me a while to learn, and I'm wondering, you know, I see this among my people that I try to introduce to craft beer, that had that same mindset of what's flavor and what's mouthfeel, you know, that thing. And it really makes a difference when I was able to start separating the two things, you know, the astringency is not flavor, you know, and those things.
Right. And sometimes it's not, if you look at the judging form, there's some that it kind of borders mouthfeel and flavor in a sense. Things like aftertaste. Well, part of aftertaste can be whether or not the beer is left with as a real dry beer or sweet. Does it have a lingering bitterness? So these beers should all have a hint of sweetness in the finish, but they're fairly dry. They're not real dry. They're not bone dry, but they're not going to be real sweet either. But that falls through over to mouthfeel, the way you sense it there too. So things like whether you have lingering bitterness in the flavor and you sense that bitterness as in mouthfeel too, as kind of on the sides of your tongue, you sense bitterness, how it you feel that in your mouth. And if you use too much hops in any beer, you can get a lot of astringency from the roughage of the hops itself. Up to 25% of the tannins in a beer can come from the hops. And so for homebrewers, one of the ways you can control that is you want a particular IBU level, use less hop matter that's got a higher alpha to get to the same IBUs. So instead of maybe picking a East Kent Goldings at an alpha acid of 3%, you might use a Northdown that might have a 9% alpha acid. You're going to use one-third the vegetable matter in the beer, contributing less to the astringency in the mouthfeel and flavor. There's ways to control those things, right?
Yeah.
I've always associated a beer's mouthfeel with like chewiness. So if you're drinking and it feels like you're chewing the beer, so then you know it's got a bigger mouthfeel versus like a lighter beer, and you don't really, with the exception of maybe the Hefeweizens where they are, because due to the yeast, it feels like you're chewing, but you're really not because it is a light body beer. But this is me. I mean, that's how I've approached it.
No, that's a good term, Boris. Some beer, particularly if you get something like a barley wine, chewy. Beers that have a lot of melanoitins kind of come across, I think, to us that way too. You know, they're kind of bready. So if you get something like a beer of Doppelbach, for instance, it's got the melanoitins and the breadiness from the Munich malt, and it's a bigger beer, fuller bodied. Chewy is an excellent descriptive term. So when you go to, if you ever go to take the test for BJCP, part of it is, what do you write? Are you writing descriptive terms that are relevant for the characteristics that you're sensing? So in mouthfeel, some things can be creamy. They could be, they could have some, you may feel some of the bitterness and astringency. You may feel some of the spritziness from carbonation. You may feel chewiness from the malt. All of those things are good terms to think about how you express what you sense as way of describing it back to the brewer.
It almost be like making risotto with beer. Man, that'd be spectacular.
My goal is making 20 recipes.
What is melanoitin?
Melanoitin is basically a compound that's created when you have amino acids and proteins and amino acids that react to heat. So when you cook a steak in a pan that's what happens to the surface that calls browning. It causes things to have kind of a, well, breadiness, bread crackery notes to it. And that's exactly what happens when you take and roast some malts, particularly like a Munich malt. It's not highly roasted, but it is roasted. And then you, particularly if you do a decoction mash where you're evaporating liquid and causing those the sugars and the proteins to interact with heat, in heat. It's sugars and proteins, or amino acids and sugars, I guess. And they form melanoitins. And we sense those melanoitins as cooked, as bready, chewy, I hate to say meaty, but, you know, in a steak, that's a good thing, and your beer, it's not. But.
Interesting. All right.
And there is a malt called melanoitin malt that's it's done intentionally to create it so that you can use a little of that to kind of a fake decoction.
Give you that character, yeah.
Give you some of that character.
Mm. Sounds like there's a
wouldn't,
malt.
Carapils, doesn't Carapils do the same? It's kind of similar to the melanoitin malt, or is that one and the same? Am I talking about the same thing?
Well, Carapils is going to be a very light crystal malt.
Okay.
So it may give you a little bit, but it's very light. It's not going to give you much. It's primarily used to add a little bit of body and mouthfeel to a light beer.
Okay. Okay. With very little, you know, adding to the gravity, very little of it.
You're usually not using enough to add much in the way of gravity or flavor. It's okay. Usually a mouthfeel more than anything else. And I think the term Cara anything is a more of a brand, because you can get Cara Munich, Cara. There's a lot of, and I think that's just one maltster's name for their line of various roasted crystal malts from range of things.
It makes total sense because it is. I noticed a particular Marcel. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Anything crystal is Cara.
Well, they're
caramel.
Yep. They're the same. It's just
still Cara. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Well, has anybody got anything else here? We can probably wrap up category four here, unless there are some questions that have been outstanding.
I don't think so.
All right. I'll take.
So just one thing, Matt, before you go.
Go ahead.
You know, if you guys get a chance, I know you all have copies of the BJCP guidelines. And you've got the copies of the BJCP judging form, or you can download it from the BJCP website. So as you taste any of these beers, like Boris is sitting there drinking a Schwartz beer tonight, fill out the form. Practice judging. What do you, the key things are perception. What do you sense? Independent whether it's good or bad, just what do you sense? When you're tasting, smelling, seeing, and feeling the beer, and write those things down.
Well, that's funny that you said that, because the other day I was thinking about we suggest that we do a Craft Beer Nation tasting, and that would be nice to use the form for that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so get used to doing that. And then you look at descriptive ability. Okay. You put hops. Well, are you tasting low, medium, high hop bitterness? What's the flavor? Is it floral? Is it piney? Is it citrusy? Grapefruity? You know, the types of descriptive words you would use to convey back to the brewer that you tasted his beer and this is what you sensed. Same thing with fruity esters. Any faults you may find in the beers. And if most commercial beers, you're not going to find too many faults. But it may be more stylistic than brewing faults. And then you can add the comments of are these things appropriate to style? So you get yourself a Dunkel, and it's a local one, and it's fruity as heck, or there's a lot of diacetyl. Well, you make that comment of what it is, and then these things are not appropriate to style. And then finally is the feedback. If you're a brewer, and it helps to be a brewer to be a judge, but you don't have to be, understand how did they get to that point? What could they do? Give them some feedback on what they could do to make corrections. Because people enter competitions partly to win things, but a lot of times they're actually looking for honest feedback. Is this a good beer? And if it's not, what can I do to make it a better one? So give them some feedback, you know. Lower your fermentation temperature for that yeast, or pitch more yeast for this lager, or look at a different strain of yeast. This one kicked off too many esters.
And remind us, those score sheets that we, that any BJCP sanctioned competition, we can, as anybody can get to the site and print them off and just use them, right?
All yep. Right. You're welcome to any use anything on the BJCP site. It's open for anybody to use, as long as it's, you know, not for commercial purpose. You're not supposed to take it and do something else with it commercially, but you're welcome to use them in competitions, use them for yourself, use them on Beer Nation, whatever.
Sweet. I need to start doing that if I want to become certified in 6 years, seven. When I get back from Germany. I mean, I got to do my duty in Germany. You know what I mean?
I mean, think how, in 6 years, think the tastings that you'll have accomplished. I mean, think of the number of beers you'll have, you know, by then.
I don't want to start to think about that just yet.
You know, I think I look at what I've consumed in the last 2 years of this hobby, and I, one, I'm concerned about my hobby, but two, two, I think if I can start to organize my thoughts in a, you know, along the lines of this BJCP kind of categories, and keep better notes other than this thing gets three caps and I like it. It'll be a more fulfilling hobby for me. That's my pursuit here. Is you know, everything is more fun with more knowledge. So,
yep.
Our homebrew club is doing up quarterly club competitions, and they just did a barley wine one. So everyone brought in, which they actually do annually. I didn't know. I'd never made a barley wine. So they make it at certain times of the year or of the year, and then a year later they do the annual competition with it. So we're now doing quarterly ones. I can only participate in the next one, which is the April one, and the next April one is Irish Reds. And, you know, I kind of swindled my way into getting them to do that because I already had brewed an Irish Red. So they use the BJCP. We have a few. I think we have two judges within the club that are certified in this state. And they use the card, and they do, like, straight legit scoring. There's no, you know, the personal level, whether you know them or not, is thrown out the window. It turns into a legit competition, and I'm really excited because I really would – it'd be the first time any of my beers get scored or judged BJCP level. So – I need to start practicing myself because I plan on attending that meeting, and I need to be able to do it properly so I can give proper feedback.
So we all need to go to a meeting. All right.
Yep, meetings.
Not a meeting.
Yeah. BJCP. Just in some different letters. Yeah, a little bit later in the alphabet. All right, well, I think let's wrap this one up here. This was a good conversation. Thanks again, David Hausman, for, you know, letting us put you on the spot. You're going to stop coming to these if we don't start getting you some help. But but in 2 weeks, we're going to come back again, and we're going to talk about Box. We're going to talk about Category 5, and I believe there are four subcategories in that one.
Right.
And, you know, I guess we can all, in a couple, you know, spend some time these next couple of weeks and drink some Box, drink some dark lager, drink some good beer of any kind. And maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea to go to vjcp.org, download some score sheets, and just try it and just start to write those things out. So I think that's probably, I wouldn't want to wait all the way to the end of these session reviews to encourage people to do that. If it's that important and that's good practice, then let's not wait until next January or February when we're all done with Category 28 to say, all right, you're now armed. Go out and start to write these things out. So that's it. I think that's our takeaway from this week. And unless anybody has any further comments, we'll just wrap this thing up and talk about Box in 2 weeks. So thanks for joining and listen to the podcast. Watch us on YouTube and join our community on Google+. Thanks.